From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with writer Mordecai Richler. His best-known works, The Apprenticeship of Dudie Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now, draw on his childhood growing up in the Jewish section of Montreal. Also today, I talk with Ron Coslow, creator of the new TV series Beauty and the Beast. It's an updated version of the fairy tale. The Beast lives in tunnels beneath the streets of modern-day Manhattan. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by John Cougar Mellencamp and Dave Alvin. And guest film critic Michael Schrago reviews Tough Guys Don't Dance, the new movie written and directed by Norman Mailer. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Mordecai Richler. He's best known for his novels The Apprenticeship of Dudie Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. Richler also wrote the screenplays for the movie adaptations. Dudie Kravitz starred Richard Dreyfuss, and Joshua starred James Woods and Alan Arkin. Richler grew up in a Jewish immigrant working-class section of Montreal. His father was a junk dealer. His grandfather was a Hasidic rabbi. As soon as he came of age at 18, he not only got out of the neighborhood, but he left Canada and Jewish culture. For 21 years, he lived abroad in England and Paris, where he wrote his early novels. But the Canadian and the Jewish working-class background he left behind became themes of both his fiction and his journalism. After 21 years abroad, Richler returned to Montreal in 1972, where he now lives, and where he has become quite celebrated. Richler has adapted his novel The Apprenticeship of Dudie Kravitz into a musical. One version opened in 1978. A new version is about to have its world premiere in Philadelphia, produced by the American Music Theater Festival. He collaborated on the adaptation with Austin Pendleton, who's directing the show. The story is about a Jewish teenage working-class kid on the make in Montreal. They hope to open on Broadway in November. Mordecai Richler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
As a writer, you found such richness in your upbringing, but I guess you didn't see that richness at the time when you were young and living in the Jewish section of Montreal.
Well, when I was a very young and foolish writer, 19 or 20, I wanted to write like Malraux or Céline, and I went off to Paris, which was a very romantic thing to do. And it never occurred to me that the people I'd grown up with were sufficiently interesting to write about, but I was soon happily cured of that foolishness.
Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, I guess it's not very different from a neighborhood in Brooklyn or Boston. It was a almost totally Jewish neighborhood. It was working class. And except for nuances, which were strictly Canadian, again, it was no different from being a young boy in working-class Brooklyn or the Bronx, I think.
One difference I could see is that in Montreal, most people probably identify with either England or France, and you're from a family from Eastern Europe.
The Jewish community in Quebec or in the province or largely in Montreal always identified with the English-speaking world because, of course, English was the language of success in that country or on this continent. However, they are among the most bilingual people in the country. But that has been a complaint of the French, that the Jewish immigrants identified with the English minority.
You've picked up Jewish inflections really well in your writing, when you're writing about people who speak that way. Well, when you were young and growing up, did you ever feel any sense of embarrassment at Yiddish or Jewish accents in your family?
Yes, alas, I did it when I got out into the larger world. But then these things have a way of boomeranging because then we lived in England and had five children there, my wife and myself. And I think at one point they were ashamed of our colonial accent, so I got we got our just desserts much later. But yes, there was a brief period when we were ashamed of our parents and the way they spoke.
Could you explain where you think that comes from? That embarrassment.
We wanted to be at that time part of the larger country, and we were accepting very shallow and foolish values. You know, I wanted to be absorbed into the larger community. Most of us got over it very quickly, and those who didn't are the people who've anglicized or changed their names or their style.
I've always wanted to know what your bar mitzvah was like, because there's a very funny bar mitzvah scene in The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz.
And oh, that had nothing to do with my own.
Well, there's this scene where somebody comes in and decides to make a documentary film on the bar mitzvah, and it always made me wonder what yours was like.
Oh, well, no, mine was a very quiet little affair in a pokey little Orthodox synagogue, a corner shul. And it was a very Orthodox community. I came from a very Orthodox family, and then we all had honey cake and whiskey, and that was it.
It was the year your parents divorced, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. So it was not the happiest of times, no.
Was there a lot of tension around how the bar mitzvah was going to be handled, or whether you were being pious enough in your learning of the prayers?
Well, I'd been quite responsible about being pious enough. I'd studied for about 6 or 8 months in order to read a portion from the Torah and to conduct the services. But there were family frictions, yes.
Your grandparents, you've written that your grandparents said that the neighborhood you grew up in was for bums and for failures. And I'm sure that that helped instill a desire in you to get out of the neighborhood, because your grandparents and parents expected that you'd, you know, rise up, the next generation betters
yes.
themselves and moves out. Mm-hmm. But they probably didn't expect you to move out of the country and move away from them like you did.
Well, no, neither did I. But I didn't so much move away as sit down in a room with it all for years. So I don't really feel I've moved away to that in that sense, because I went off to Europe, it's true, but what I was writing about was that place and that time.
Are you one of the people who finds it easier to write about something when you're far away from it?
Well, it's conjecture. I mean, I don't know whether I would have been a better writer had I remained in Canada, but I left Canada in 1951. It was then a different country. It had a population of about 12 or 14 million, and it was a very provincial country, and I found it very boring and wanted to get out. And at that time, I felt, being Canadian, that if I were going to prove to myself that I was a writer, I had to do it in London or New York. And that was very much feeling of Canadians of my generation at that time. If you were going to do anything, you had to leave the country.
Well, there isn't, you know, there's a great, American literary heritage, and there's this whole image of the great American mm-hmm. novel, which so many novelists hope to one day write.
Yes.
Is there any literary heritage that you felt you could have been part of in Canada?
No, but I mean, certainly, I'm talking about 1951. But since then, we've had some very fine writing done in Canada. I mean, there are people like Alice Munro and Mavis Gallant and
Margaret
Robinson
Atwood.
Davies and Margaret Atwood and others. So Canadian writing has flourished to a certain extent in recent years. But at that time, no. And there was very little. I mean, there was Morley Callahan and there was Hugh McLennan, but there wasn't very much else.
You've also written that when you were growing up, the attitude of parents and grandparents was work was good for our character, and the fact that we were paid was incidental. This is a kind of real work ethic. Did you, when you started to write, when you quit college to travel, ever feel a sense of guilt that you weren't working the kind of working man's 9-to-5 job?
Well, I guess at that age, I give something for the arrogance I had at that age. So
yeah, you once described yourself as cocky.
So you think the world is out there waiting for your work. You soon learn otherwise. But I guess it's a necessary part of any writer's equipment when he's very young to think that what he's doing is of some significance or importance. And so there is a fundamental conceit involved. It is hard work, so I've never felt that I was loafing on the job.
No, but I think a lot of working class parents who were brought up with 9-to-5 jobs don't understand that when you're sitting there staring at the ceiling, waiting for the word to come, that you're working.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, they did not. But I mean, I wasn't there.
You weren't there, and it didn't matter.
Yeah, so it didn't matter. They didn't know where I was or whatever.
Novelist Mordecai Richler is my guest. Why did you return to Montreal after 21 years?
Well, it never occurred to me that I could ever become an Englishman. we'd lived there all those years, and it was really rather wonderful. And my wife misses London very much to this day, as I do to some extent. But after I'd written a novel called St. Urban's Horseman, I felt I could no longer write novels if I stayed on in England, because I hadn't been born there and brought up there. And a novelist's head has to be filled with a lot of very foolish and banal detail, like you have to know who the football players were, what price the haircut was, where you got fish and chips. And if you had to sit down and research these things, it all became rather frantic and foolish, because that wasn't the important stuff. It should have been there at your disposal. And so I felt if I stayed on in England, I would not be writing more novels, but I'd just be writing films. And so my family, who are all very loyal, understood, and we came back to Canada. And then I was able to travel a good deal in America, and I'd never really been an adult on this continent. And we get back to Europe once a year, my wife and I.
When you returned to Canada and you started meeting your Canadian readers, were you surprised at how your work was being received there?
Well, no, it's a bit deceptive in that over the last 10 years in England, I was back in Canada at least once a year on an assignment of some kind. So it wasn't a surprise or foreign territory to me, really. I had been to and fro an awful lot.
I think some Canadians interpreted your work as being as defaming the Jews and defaming Canada. How did you react to that?
Well, my Jewish problem really began and ended with The Apprenticeship of Dirty Kravitz, which offended a lot of people in the Jewish community in Montreal. It's about a boy with his eye on the main chance who doesn't always behave in the most civil manner. But Dirty Kravitz was not meant as a metaphor for the Jewish people. He was a kind of boy I grew up with and knew very well. My Canadian problem is that I'm not a nationalist or a cultural nationalist, and I've written, at length here and there, ridiculing certain aspects of cultural nationalism. So it would not be unfair to say I'm not the most popular man in cultural circles there, or in some cultural circles.
But you become quite celebrated in Canada.
I guess so, yes.
Right. I think there's a lot of really interesting contradictions in your family life, because when you were a child, there were, just from reading what you've written, there seems to have been a lot of serious falling outs within the family. But as an adult, you seem to have such a tight-knit family of your own. You've been married a long time, 5 children. You referred earlier to the loyalty.
Yes, we're a very close family, and I'm here with my wife. And our children will be coming in next week, well, most of them. One's in London, so he can't come in.
Like the main character in Joshua Then and Now, you married a woman who wasn't Jewish. Did this cause conflict in your family?
Yes, yeah, sure, of course it did, yes. But that was a long time ago. So it doesn't really cause any conflict now, any longer.
Do you think that actions like that are sometimes misinterpreted by families or by other people who sometimes see you as wanting to, you know, get out of the culture you were brought into, and that it's somehow your ticket out into a different life, a different world?
Well, the thing is, I'm more involved with the culture I was brought up with than they are. So I don't really trouble myself about these things.
You went through years of your life, I think, not speaking with your grandfather. He roughed you up once. This is the way you describe it. After you,
my paternal grandfather. Yes, we did not get on. No.
Yeah, because you had violated the Sabbath once, and
that's right.
And
yes.
He roughed you up, and that was it. You didn't talk to him again.
That's right.
How come the falling out was so serious?
Well, I guess you're. I wrote a piece for Esquire called "My Father's Life." Is that what you're?
I think so. Yeah.
Yes. Well, my grandfather was a very bad-tempered, relentlessly orthodox Jew. And he ran a junkyard, and I discovered him not being entirely honest on the scales with some people who came in. And that was the end of it all for me. I no longer accepted his authority on any moral issues. And I did not make any secret of this, and I guess it was not A delightful thing to come from a 12 or 13 year old. So naturally, he objected strenuously. And there was just bad feeling between us from then on until he died.
After seeing Joshua then and now, I think everybody wondered if you had a father who was a small-time criminal.
No, my father was a very honest and gentle man. And my father's never been to a boxing match in his life, or never mind being a retired boxer or a small-time criminal. And I had nothing to do with my father at all. It was a total invention.
Had you fantasized what it would have been like to have a father who was that colorful?
Well, when you're working on a novel, you're fantasizing, as it were, all the time. So, but it's not a character that was really based on anybody, the father and Joshua. And my mother was not a stripteaser either.
You were estranged from your mother, too, for a long time.
Yes, but that's a very private matter.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Well, my guest is Mordecai Richler, and his books include The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. Judy Kravitz is about to open as a musical. It gets its premiere in Philadelphia, and then, if things go well, moves on to Broadway. We're going to talk some more about Mordecai Richler's life and his writing after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Novelist Mordecai Richler is my guest. You were talking earlier about there having not been much of a Canadian literary tradition when you started writing, but there.
Yeah, but we all belong. You know, that's deceptive too. We all belong to a much larger tradition, which was English and really North American. So that we were a generation of writers brought up, you know, in Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Henry James and Mark Twain, and so. We weren't so parochial that we limited ourselves strictly to Canadian writing.
In Canada and in some areas, there are content quotas. I believe even on the radio, you're expected to play a certain number of Canadian artists.
That's right, yes.
Per hour or per day. I wonder what you think of that as a Canadian-bred artist.
Well, you know, I think there's only one standard, and that's excellence, and that everyone should strive toward that, or as close as they can come to it. So I do deplore any kind of quota system, really. But I, when you get into areas such as pop music or radio, it becomes much more complicated. And that Canadians are overwhelmed by American radio and TV and American popular culture, so they have to take certain defensive measures in terms of popular culture. When you're dealing with bookshops or theater, I find it abhorrent that certain nationalists at one time had proposed that there should be a content quota on books coming in. I mean, I found that offensive and rather silly.
You've made two movies that were filmed in Canada and were produced in Canada.
Yes.
The Apprenticeship of Judy Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. You adapted your own novels for the screen. Did you rework them a lot for the movie versions?
Yes. Well, in both cases, I worked with a very old friend of mine, Ted Kotcheff, with whom I'd made films in London. And in the case of Judy Kravitz, it was not really all that difficult because he's not a character with a very rich inner life. The novel is filled with incident. It's also linear and confined to about 3 or 4 years of his life. Joshua Then Now was an extremely difficult script to do, and it was never really very successful as a script because I tried to squeeze too much into it. So at times it came on like a synopsis, I think. And it was a much more intricately structured novel. So it was oppressive, and it took a lot of work, and I don't think I ever quite got it right.
It's semi-autobiographical.
Well, it is and it isn't, really. I shared some of the ideas of the character, but actually, I mean, the character of Jacob Hirsch and St. Urban's Horseman is much closer to being autobiographical.
Did James Woods, who played the main character in Joshua, spend any time with you get a sense of your life or your mannerisms?
Well, we spent a bit of time together, and I didn't like being watched in that sense, so because I didn't want the character to resemble me either physically or in any other way. But Woods is a very acute actor and was just looking for things at all times. You know? I was very pleased with what he did. I was especially pleased with Alan Arkin's performance in the film.
That was, I think, the most expensive movie up until that point produced in Canada.
Yes, but again...
But I was wondering if there was a lot riding on it, the sense of...
let me stop you for a moment. Yeah. It cost about... $10 million Canadian dollars, which meant that it was a budget of about $6.5 million American dollars, which is
very
small.
Cheap by these versions, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just deceptive. I mean, it wasn't a very expensive film by international standards. But it is appalling what films cost to make, really. And it's quite terrifying, I find.
Was this a sense in Canada that this film had to do well?
Yeah, there was a lot of...
To serve the Canadian film industry?
Hype and a bit too much excitement before the event, yes.
Now you are reworking Judy Kravitz for a stage musical, which is about to open in Philadelphia.
Well, that's been done as far... I mean,
the script's done.
Yeah, I've been working on a novel for about 3 years, and I'm living out in the country now and trying to get that finished. So that's my primary concern, really.
When you work on a theater production or a movie, and suddenly there's this whole team of people who are reworking your ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enjoyable or frustrating?
Well, I find it very difficult. I don't excel at group activities, and having been a novelist all these years, I'm used to going up to my room and being in total control, for better or for worse, of what I'm doing. So I find it difficult and unnerving to share in all these things. And, of course, a musical is very much a group activity. So I've been staying away and collaborating in a one-hand removed, as it were. Austin sends me, Austin Pendleton, one draft, and then I work on it and send it back to him. But I've not been sitting in with the whole company very much. I'm not very good at that.
There was, I think, a 9-year period between... Joshua Then and Now and your previous novel. Were you working on movies then, or was that a hard time?
No, I brought out a couple of children's books and a book of essays.
Have you ever had writer's block?
Well, I work much more slowly now than I did when I was 25 or 26. I think you become much more critical of your own work. And it's no longer an event merely to publish. So... In your own mind, anyway, it has to be something special. I mean, you can always be wrong. But I don't see any point in just bringing out one novel after another, you know. So I'm much more exacting now, I think, and it takes me much longer.
Do you know when an idea is good enough to work into a novel? Or do you have to work it through and then see what happens to it?
You have to work it through and see what happens to it. And sometimes you can be very wrong and 2 years older when you find out. So, I mean, there are no guarantees, but I wasn't drafted for this job. I volunteered, so I'm not really complaining.
When did you first start to write?
When I was about 18 or 19, I went off to Paris. 19.
You hadn't written before you went?
Well, I guess every kid of 16 writes, or who's at college.
Mostly bad poetry, I think.
Mostly. Oh, I wrote that, too. Yeah.
You painted, too, didn't you?
Oh, too much has been made out of that. No, I drew and painted, yes. Well. But I went off to Paris to write. I guess you would say now I dropped out of college. We didn't... Use that expression then. And that's all I've ever done ever since. I regret in one way that I was published so early.
Why?
Well, a number of writers I know have had to wait longer, and therefore they've spent 5 or 6 years or 7 years doing jobs they abhorred, but they have that experience to draw on now of office life or factory life or whatever. I don't, because I've never done anything but write. So, I mean, it was very pleasant at the time to be 21 or 22 and have a novel in print. It wasn't a very good novel, but it was in print. But with hindsight, I wish it had been a somewhat longer struggle, and I would have had that experience to draw on now.
Was this the kind of thing that makes you want to go on little adventures or go to different places so you have more to draw on for stories?
Between novels, I haven't got the kind of imagination anyway that can run from one novel to another. I very much like going out on assignment for magazines, because it takes me out of the house and it thrusts me into worlds I don't know and into idioms I'm unfamiliar with. So I find it very useful, yes, and very nourishing.
I want to get back to your childhood, which you kind of left to go to Europe, but you've been writing about what you grew up with ever since. Do you ever ask yourself what your parents or grandparents would have thought of your novels if they could read them now?
Well, my parents have been able to read them.
Have they been able to?
Well, my father died before. Well, he read some of them, yes. And it was very gratifying that he was quite pleased toward the end. But he wasn't a man with any great literary experience. I mean, my father reading was confined to the Reader's Digest, really. So, but it was just the idea of seeing his son's work in print. Happily gave him some pleasure, finally.
Did it make him feel vindicated, too, in a way, that the culture that he brought you up in ended up serving you as a writer?
Well, it made him feel vindicated because, his own life was very much of a failure. But, I mean, he would have felt the same vindication had I become a pop singer, or it was just the notion that his son was a success, I guess, which was pleasing to him.
Have you been driven to succeed because of your upbringing, do you think?
It's the only upbringing I've ever had, so it's a very difficult question to answer. I like to think I've been driven to try to write well, really, on my own terms.
Do you read other people when you're writing?
Well, I do an awful lot of reading, yes, and then I'm a judge at the Book of the Month Club, so I have to do a lot of reading for the club as well. So I do quite a bit of reading, yes. But I do a lot of reading for my own pleasure as well.
Who are the authors that have inspired you?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of authors, a number of people I read with great pleasure. I think Walker Percy is a fine writer in this country now, and I've always admired, Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and a writer I have enormous regard for, I always have had, is Evelyn Waugh's Evelyn Waugh. So, I mean, I'm a reader as well as being a writer. So all kinds of people I read.
You're working on a new novel. Can you say anything about it, or would you rather not?
I'd rather not.
Okay, well, I wish you the best with it. How far finished is it?
Well, I hope to finish by the end of the year.
Okay. Well, good luck with it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
My guest has been novelist Mordecai Richler, whose books include The Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz and Joshua Then and Now. Both of them have been made into movies. The Apprenticeship of Duty Kravitz is about to open as a musical. It's being produced by the American Music Theater Festival and will have its American premiere soon in Philadelphia. And then, if things go well, we'll move on to Broadway in November. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Ron Coslow, creator of the new TV series Beauty and the Beast, talks about transforming the abandoned tunnels beneath Manhattan into a secret world, the home of the Beast. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Lonesome Jubilee by John Cougar Mellencamp and Romeo's Escape by Dave Alvin. And guest film critic Michael Schrago reviews Tough Guys Don't Dance, starring Ryan O'Neill and Isabella Rossellini. It's directed by Norman Mailer and based on his novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of new albums by John Cougar Mellencamp and Dave Alvin. They're performers who write songs about the working class and the dispossessed.
This past weekend, Willie Nelson presented the third of his Farm Aid concerts, shows featuring rock and country performers designed to raise money for failing farms across the nation. John Cougar Mellencamp and Dave Alvin both performed at that concert, and both have just released provocative albums, Mellencamp's The Lonesome Jubilee and Alvin's Romeo's Escape. Mellencamp is the primary victim of what might be called the curse of patriotic rock. Ever since Bruce Springsteen recorded Born in the USA, any rocker who mentions America in a song lyric is doomed to comparison with the boss, as well as to humorless analysis by critics eager to find the next voice of the rock and roll working class. To his credit, Mellencamp has resisted any temptation to pontificate. His last few albums, and certainly this new one, aren't flag wavers or flag burners. They deal with political issues only in the sense that the lyrics dramatize lives that are increasingly shut out of rock songs. Lower middle class and poor people, two groups that don't fit into the big business perspective that has dominated rock since the mid-70s. Here's a good example of what might be called John Cougar Mellencamp's politics by implication. It's a meat and potatoes rock song called Hot Dogs and Hamburgers.
And I was just a kid. Met a pretty little Indian girl along the way. Got her into my car and tried to give her a kiss. I'll give you a beast and warmth, whatever it takes, yeah, to make you trip. She jumped into the back seat, she kind of flipped her lid. She said, "Johnny, something for nothing, like a pilgrim." Sun went away, and I realized it was sort of an honor being around this girl. I felt embarrassed at what I tried to do earlier that day. She was the saddest girl I ever knew. She told me stories about the Indian nation, how the white man stole their lives away. And although she kind of liked me, she could never trust me. When the sun comes up, we go our different ways. Choice between hot dogs and hamburgers. Every one of us got to choose between right and wrong.
John Cougar Mellencamp from his new album, The Lonesome Jubilee. Another rocker with something on his mind besides party time is Dave Alvin, who's been a member of two outstanding Los Angeles bands, The Blasters and X. Alvin's new solo album, Romeo's Escape, is the rock equivalent of a Woody Guthrie record. Alvin is obsessed with the romance and tragedy of the hobo, the uprooted, and the small-time musician on the road. This is a limited worldview that Alvin makes exciting because he's an exceptionally good songwriter. Even more than Mellencamp, Dave Alvin's images are terse and evocative, full of vivid scenes in the lives he describes. Here's a bit from Jubilee Train, in which the wordplay combines with a tough rockabilly rhythm to give life to the outcast that Alvin admires. Dave Alvin from his new album, Romeo's Escape. Neither of these records are great ones. Mellencamp could use more humor and Alvin more of a voice, but there's no denying the emotion in their songs or the compassionate ideas behind them.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
If you're feeling shut down, may my thoughts be with you. If you're a black man being beat down, shoved all around, may my thoughts be with you. If your world's getting a little too tough, you know our thoughts are with you.
John Cougar Mellencamp from his album The Lonesome Jubilee, this is Fresh Air. Generations have grown up with the fairy tale Beauty and the Beast. It's been retold many times and was the basis of a 1946 movie by Jean Cocteau. It's also the inspiration for a new TV series that begins this Friday night. Last year, a CBS programming executive saw the Cocteau film and began to explore the possibilities of a modern-day version. My guest, Ron Coslow, was hired to create the show's pilot, and he became the supervising producer for the series Beauty and the Beast. He describes it this way.
It's a love story. It's a story of, it's actually a contemporary fable. It's a story of a Catherine who was a very wealthy socialite, Upper East Side attorney. And she's attacked and slashed and left for dead in Central Park. And this is really the way the story begins. She is found by Vincent, who is this man-beast who lives in the tunnels in a subterranean world below Manhattan. And it's about their the bond between the two of them, their empathic relationship.
Vincent is half-man and half-beast. Actually, he looks like half man and half lion.
Yeah, there is a feline quality to him. How he got that way, we are intentionally leaving mysterious for the time being. But he is not a deformed person. He is really another species. If you took a sample of his blood and checked the DNA code, it would be unlike anything you've ever seen.
The Beauty and the Beast in the show have a deep love for each other and a deep understanding, but I assume that the love is not going to ever be consummated sexually because, after all, he's a beast. Is this going to be the ultimate safe sex kind of show?
Well, people have asked me that. I really, it certainly wasn't intended to be that. One of the interesting things about their relationship is that because, for the moment anyway, that kind of consummation isn't possible, it allows us to explore a different kind of communion between the two of them. And maybe it harkens back to the times when lovers made love with words and ideas and thoughts and emotions rather than jumping into bed.
This beast lives under the streets of Manhattan in a series of tunnels, and these tunnels connect to the underground subways of Manhattan. And the beast lives there, his adopted father lives there, and you get a sense that there's this whole alternative culture that's living under the streets of New York.
Yes.
How did you come up with this idea of a culture living underground in Manhattan?
I had read there were a couple of newspaper articles in the late 70s about people living in the steam tunnels below the Waldorf Astoria, and they were homeless people, but it was winter, and they had found a place where there was warmth, and they were actually foraging their food from the restaurant at the Waldorf and eating quite well. And while these were by no means great circumstances, it really intrigued me, the idea that there was this whole network of New York. I think one of the problems of New York, of course, is the geography, is the fact that everybody is jammed up together. And just below the city streets is a world that there are at least 300 miles of tunnels below New York. Many of them are uncharted. Many of the maps have been lost. And it really piqued my imagination.
Do you know what those tunnels were created for?
Yes, they were for different purposes. They really began digging tunnels about 150 years ago for water conduits. At a certain point in the early part of this century, many of the buildings were heated by steam, so there were steam tunnels. There were electrical circuit tunnels. Many of the phone lines in New York are run through tunnels. So there's a whole archaeology of tunnels and tunnel systems below the city streets in Manhattan.
What did it feel like to go deep underground and walk around these tunnels?
Well, it's interesting. We were there in early spring, so it was still cold. And these particular tunnels, which were near the reservoir, were a little chilly. But there's an incredible solitude and a wonderful stillness down there. You know, as you descend, you lose all that buzz and noise from the streets above, and you're standing there. It's a very odd feeling. You can be standing there. You're really standing in the center of Manhattan. You know, not far from the 86th Street Traverse, and there's utter stillness, and it's quite wonderful. Actually, it's quite very magical.
I think that this part of Beauty and the Beast is such a New York fantasy, this whole idea of an underground culture. You're walking on the streets, and there's people
Yes.
living underneath you. Yet you've lived in Los Angeles since you were 10, and I'm interested in how you've really captured such a New York fantasy.
My family lives in New York and has lived there for quite a while, and I spent a lot of time in New York and am constantly amazed and intrigued by it. And one of the reasons I wanted to do this show is because I really wanted to do something. I truly believe that New York is a magical place, and I wanted to do a story that dealt with some of that. It really seems to me to be the contemporary primeval forest. It's just everywhere you look. You walk down 57th Street on a normal evening, and every second step you take knocks you out. You see something that just absolutely stuns you.
You know, a lot of people don't know about these tunnels, and I think through your TV show, they're going to find out about it. Do you think that a lot more people are going to be trying to get underground now, and especially people who are homeless who have no place to live and who would be finding shelter there?
I think there already are a lot of homeless people who are living in some of these tunnels. Many of the tunnels that we're talking about are almost impossible to get into.
How did you get down into them?
With the help of the city of New York and the Parks Department.
And do they not want you to tell publicly where the entrances are and how to do it?
We really can't tell how to get down there. And even if we did tell exactly where the entrance was, it would be impossible for anyone to really get down there at this point.
Did you reread the fairy tale of Beauty and the Beast or see the Cocteau movie before writing the pilot?
Yes. You know, I was familiar with the fairy tale, and I had seen the Cocteau film and was always impressed by it and affected by it. And it really seemed to take the fairy tale a quantum leap. It into surreal directions, into erotic directions, and I was influenced by that.
When you first read the fairy tale or had it read to you as a child, who did you identify with, the beauty or the beast?
That's a good question. I think probably both. I mean, that's the interesting thing about the myth, is that it does appeal to both sides, and it is about in certain ways, acceptance of both sides of yourself. I mean, I believe it's part of a cycle of those transformation myths, which are meant to teach children, to look beyond the surfaces and to search for the inner good and inner beauty. But I think that applies not only in dealing with another, but also in confronting yourself. So, I mean, I think that perhaps a myth is designed to appeal for you to identify with both.
Where are you going to watch the premiere episode?
Well, we're going to be working. We'll be shooting. We'll be shooting, I guess, in Vincent's chamber that night. And I think we'll finish early and set up a TV and watch the pilot and have some champagne and feel very happy and lucky.
And then get back to work. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ron Coslow is the creator and supervising producer for the new TV series Beauty and the Beast. It begins Friday night on CBS. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
Well, every day at this time, we talk about what stories you're following for All Things Considered. But today, I'd like to know how you decide what stories you're going to follow.
Well, we decide first that every day we should have, I guess, five or six major news stories from abroad, from Washington, from around the country, stories which we think you'll hear the first serious treatment of, the first good reporting of, on All Things Considered. You may later hear some more or read some more about it, but first here. Then interviews that would illuminate those stories a bit, and then some feature pieces about people not only in the news, but also in the arts and sciences.
Well, thank you, Robert, and stay tuned for full coverage of the news on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our film critic Stephen Schiff is on vacation for the next couple of weeks, so we've invited guest critic Michael Schrago to join us. He has a review of the new Norman Mailer movie Tough Guys Don't Dance. It stars Ryan O'Neill and Isabella Rossellini. Mailer adapted the screenplay from his 1984 thriller.
Now, what happened with you and the woman? I don't remember. If Pangborn killed himself, somebody drove the vehicle afterward. The blood on the floor of the trunk coagulated with a ripple. Go back to your night with Jessica and Lonnie. Did you bang her? I may have.
Every year brings a new variation of that wretched and peculiar kind of movie, the macho camp film. In 1986, it was the rivetingly awful Runaway Train. In 1987, it's the turgidly awful Tough Guys Don't Dance, written and directed by Norman Mailer. Both were produced by Canon Films. If producers Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus don't have any cash left in their coffers, they do have lead in their canon. These movies are supposed to offer things that typical camp does not, visceral mixtures of beer-soaked platitudes and gory action. In Tough Guys, the hero, Tim Madden, played by Ryan O'Neill, is a writer living in Provincetown. He hasn't written much lately. What's worse, someone seems to be trying to pin a couple of murders on him. Luckily, his father, Dougie, a grizzled ex-bartender, comes around and helps him analyze the corpses.
The one who's not your wife?
Jessica.
Machete. One big stroke. She was dead already. 22 hollow tip fight into her mouth.
And Patty?
Probably a bullet in the heart. And somebody used a knife to sever the head. There were no other marks on her head.
Just stop repeating that word.
What, head?
Yeah, it gets to me.
Well, there's no substitute.
Use their names.
Hey, you're as sensitive as your mother. May she rest in peace.
Macho camp movies are just as over the top in their blood and guts form of heterosexuality as normal camp movies are in their sexual ambivalence. They have their own blend of sadomasochism and hysteria. They insist too much on their own masculinity. Their heroes have to prove their manhood by taking hideous punishment, often in the form of verbal blasts from their ex-girlfriends. The stiltedness of this movie isn't the usual stiltedness. It isn't a matter of halting, stammering actors or stretches of non-action. Mailer fills the screen with sex, a seance, killings, headless corpses and the missing heads, cocaine, and, in the big disgusto moment, a corpse winched up from a garbage can. He's even hired real actors. The most amusing are Lawrence Tierney as Dougie and John Bedford Lloyd as Tim's former Exeter classmate. Maybe their performances work because they hover around the plot until the end, and their lines are meant to be funny. Despite all the explicit action, the movie rests stillborn somewhere inside Norman Mailer's brain, a location I think would be perfect for a future Doonesbury comic strip.
Michael Schrago is movie critic for the San Francisco Examiner. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Peter Wagg, creator of Max Headroom. Max now stars in his own TV series as the computer-generated alter ego of an ace television reporter. Singer Ian Whitcomb will take us back to the Tin Pan Alley era, and critic Ken Tucker will review the home video releases of films directed by Sam Peckinpah. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.